The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network is proud to present Mark Weber's World Watch. Mark Weber is director of the Institute for Historical Review, an independent think tank and publishing center. Visit them at ihr.org. And now, here's your host, Mark Weber.
Hello. 30 years ago, the U.S. Congress set up a unit of the Justice Department called the Office of Special Investigations, the OSI, to go after alleged Nazi war criminals living in the U.S. Well, when something in the government is called special, it's worth taking a closer look. Over the years, one of the OSI's highest profile targets has been John Demjanjuk, an 89-year-old man born in Ukraine who has lived most of his life in a suburb of Cleveland, Ohio. Demjanjuk has recently been back in the news because the OSI is trying to deport him to Germany to stand trial for having been a guard at a German camp in World War II. Right now, it's not clear if he will finally be deported or not. His family is trying to persuade a court to let him stay in Ohio, saying that he is so frail and in such poor health that he might not survive deportation. Demjanjuk's astonishing and shameful ordeal has dragged on for 30 years. In 1979, the U.S. government's Office of Special Investigations charged that during World War II, Demjanjuk had been a guard at the Treblinka camp, where he was known as Ivan the Terrible, a particularly brutal and sadistic guard who allegedly drove many thousands of Jews into gas chambers. Over the years, I have followed the Demjanjuk case pretty closely. Nearly 30 years ago, I met in Cleveland with his attorney and with others who were helping his legal campaign. I also attended a courtroom hearing in Cleveland where Demjanjuk was fighting for his freedom. In 1986, the U.S. deported Demjanjuk to Israel, where he was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death. Although he insisted that he was never even at Treblinka, a dozen Jewish witnesses identified Demjanjuk as the camp's notorious Ivan the Terrible. His family, friends, and lawyers did not give up. In Russian archives, they found evidence that the real Ivan the Terrible was a man named Ivan Marchenko. So compelling was this evidence that Israel's Supreme Court set aside the verdict. After being held behind bars in Israel for 7 years, including 5 years on death row, Demjanjuk was released in 1993. He returned to Ohio, and his U.S. citizenship was restored. In November 1993, a U.S. Court of Appeals sharply rebuked the government's handling of the case, saying that attorneys of the Office of Special Investigations had fraudulently withheld evidence that they knew would have exonerated Demjanjuk. The three federal court judges declared, "We hold that the OSI attorneys acted with reckless disregard for the truth and for the government's obligation to take no steps that prevent an adversary from presenting his case fully and fairly. This was fraud on the court in the circumstances of this case where, by recklessly assuming Demjanjuk's guilt, they failed to observe their obligations to produce exculpatory materials requested by Demjanjuk." The judges said that the U.S. government prosecutors had been under pressure from Jewish groups to win the Demjanjuk case. The judges noted that the Anti-Defamation League, one of America's most influential Jewish Zionist organizations, had sponsored a lecture tour in Israel by the head of the OSI. Even though the OSI and its supporters were humiliated by this judicial and public relations fiasco, they did not give up. The OSI brought a new case against Demjanjuk, now charging that he had been a guard at the Sobibor camp during the same time they had once insisted he had been a guard at the Treblinka camp. The OSI was admitting, in effect, that its much-publicized earlier case against Demjanjuk had been based on flimsy or falsified evidence and worthless or perjured testimony. Now, some 16 years after he was released from an Israeli jail, he faces deportation to Germany to stand trial for having been a guard at another wartime camp. The Office of Special Investigations was set up in 1979 as a result of the efforts, above all, of two Jewish members of Congress, Joshua Eilberg and Elizabeth Holtzman. Their push to establish this special government agency was given a big boost by the broadcast some months earlier of Holocaust, a four-part television miniseries broadcast on the NBC network, which featured a stellar cast and which was given tremendous media promotion. In conjunction with the much-hyped broadcast, the Jewish Zionist Anti-Defamation League carried out its own well-organized Holocaust media and PR campaign. During that same period, President Carter established the so-called President's Commission on the Holocaust, which was given wide and supportive media coverage. This commission was reorganized in 1980 as a permanent taxpayer-funded federal government agency, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Council, which runs the enormous U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C. All this fostered a climate that made it easier for the organized Jewish community to successfully press for new laws and new government agencies to still further advance Jewish Zionist interests. The real character and motives of the U.S. government's campaign against Demjanjuk and other alleged Nazis becomes more obvious when we take a closer look at some other OSI cases. Perhaps the most prominent target of the OSI's special brand of vigilance has been Kurt Waldheim, the Austrian diplomat who served for 10 years as Secretary General of the United Nations and 5 years as President of Austria. In 1987, at the urging of the Office of Special Investigations, the U.S. government banned Waldheim from the United States. He is the first head of state to be legally barred from this country. This ban came after an intense worldwide campaign by Jewish groups, especially the World Jewish Congress, which was strongly supported by the Jewish-controlled media. Edgar Bronfman, the Jewish billionaire who, as president of the World Jewish Congress, played a major role in the international campaign against Waldheim, revealed the ugly and hateful spirit of this effort in a speech in June 1989 to a large meeting of Jews in Canada, where he called the people of Austria, and I quote, "dirty anti-Semitic dogs." The campaign, which highlighted Waldheim's service during World War II as a German army lieutenant, consisted almost entirely of name-calling and groundless innuendo, because his detractors were unable to produce any evidence that Waldheim was guilty of any criminal wrongdoing. An international commission of historians concluded that he was not involved in any war crimes or atrocities, and even Simon Wiesenthal, the famed Nazi hunter, said, "There is absolutely no evidence the man was involved in crimes." Former Austrian Chancellor Bruno Kreisky, himself of Jewish ancestry, called the World Jewish Congress campaign an extraordinary infamy. And he added that in Austria's 1986 presidential election, the people of Austria, quote, "won't allow the Jews abroad to order us about and tell us who should be our president." The legal basis for the U.S. government ban against Waldheim was the so-called Holtzman Amendment, a 1978 amendment to U.S. immigration law named after its sponsor, Elizabeth Holtzman, a Jewish congresswoman from New York who also played a major role in setting up the OSI. The Holtzman Amendment bans from the United States anyone who, and I quote, "ordered, incited, assisted, or otherwise participated in," unquote, Nazi persecution based on, again quoting, race, religion, national origin, or political opinion. For U.S. officials, the word assisted here means that anyone who merely served in the German armed forces during World War II is regarded as having assisted in persecution. Holtzman herself pointed out in an item published in 1986 that, according to the statute named after her, it is immaterial, that's her term, whether Waldheim actually participated in any crimes or atrocities. Merely by serving in the German army during the war, she wrote, Waldheim, quote, at least assisted Nazi persecution, and under our law, this is enough to require that he be excluded. It is not necessary to prove that he is guilty of what is commonly known as war crimes, unquote. Probably the most embarrassing U.S. government case against a so-called Nazi war criminal is that of Frank Wallace. In January 1977, the U.S. government accused this Polish-born resident of Chicago of having committed atrocities against Jews as a Gestapo agent in Poland during World War II. In a Chicago courtroom, U.S. prosecutors put 11 Jewish witnesses on the stand who testified that they had seen Wallace murder children, an old woman, a young woman, a hunchback, and others. In Chicago during this period, Wallace was physically attacked and vilified in a hateful, nearly hysterical media campaign. Fortunately, his attorney was able to find German documents that conclusively proved that the Jewish eyewitness evidence was worthless or perjured, and that Wallace had not even been in Poland during the war years. The documents showed that during the war years, Wallace had been a quiet farm laborer in Germany. Another flimsy OSI case involved a man in California, Martin Bartesz. During World War II, the 16-year-old Bartesz served for a few weeks as a perimeter guard at the German concentration camp of Mauthausen. The OSI did not claim that Bartesz had carried out any atrocities. Merely his service as a guard was enough under U.S. law to revoke his citizenship and force him to leave the country. A similar OSI case involved John Hansel, a resident of Des Moines, Iowa, who was born in what is now Croatia. The OSI went after him because he had served as a guard at two German camps during the war. In this case as well, merely his service as a camp guard was sufficient legal basis to revoke his U.S. citizenship. OSI officials did not even try to claim that he had personally mistreated anyone. Andrew Kuras, a man who was born in Poland and who lived for years in New Jersey, was likewise stripped of his citizenship simply because he had served as a guard at German camps during the war. Once again, there was no claim that Kuras had ever personally mistreated or abused anyone. Commenting on the case, a U.S. government official said, "Justice for the victims of the Holocaust compels us to pursue those who abetted the Nazis' genocidal plans."
Don't go away, because there's more on Mark Weber's World Watch. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com.
Today we're announcing the addition of Daniel Andreas San Diego to the FBI's Most Wanted Terrorist list. San Diego is the first domestic terrorist to be included on the Most Wanted Terrorist list, a list that has historically been reserved for international terrorists indicted for various acts of terrorism against U.S. interest. San Diego's criminal acts of violence were domestic acts of terror planned out and possibly intended to take lives, destroy property, and create economic hardship for the companies involved. The FBI is announcing today a reward of up to $250,000 for information leading to the location and arrest of Daniel Andreas San Diego. San Diego is a known San Francisco Bay area animal rights extremist involved with the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty Campaign, commonly referred to as SHAC. SHAC was formed in 1999 by a group of animal rights extremists in England. Their single goal was putting Huntington Life Sciences out of business and interrupting Huntington's ability to conduct animal experimentation for medical, pharmaceutical, agrochemical, industrial chemical, and veterinarian product industries. The SHAC campaign expanded to the United States in the year 2000.
Let's return to Mark Weber's World Watch, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com. And now, here is your host, Mark Weber.
Another remarkable OSI case involved a Russian-born academic named Vladimir Sokolov. For nearly 20 years, from 1959 until 1976, he taught Russian language and Soviet dissident literature at Yale University. In June 1986, he was stripped of his U.S. citizenship for having concealed his wartime work as an anti-communist writer for a German-controlled newspaper. In 1942 and 1943, he had written numerous articles, including some hostile to Jews, for a German-sponsored Russian-language newspaper in his native Russian city of Orel. Sokolov was never accused of actually harming or mistreating anyone. He was stripped of his U.S. citizenship, threatened with deportation to the Soviet Union, and forced into exile in Canada because, U.S. authorities said, his writings assisted, quote-unquote, in persecution. Of course, it's worth noting here that Sokolov's writings were and are entirely legal here in the United States. When someone outside the U.S. wants a visa to visit this country, he has to fill out a long form. One of the questions on the U.S. visa application is this, quote, have you ever ordered, incited, assisted, or otherwise participated in the persecution of any person because of race, religion, national origin, or political opinion under the control, direct or indirect, of the Nazi government of Germany or the government of any area occupied by or allied with the Nazi government of Germany? A similar question appears on the form to apply for U.S. permanent residence status. The U.S. ban against visitors or residents who carried out or assisted in persecution applies only to persons associated with the governments of Nazi Germany or its allies. If U.S. law and policy were truly motivated by justice, the U.S. would ban visitors and residents who had persecuted anyone based on race, religion, or political opinion. If its policy was truly just and consistent, the U.S. would keep out nearly everyone from Israel, where military service is obligatory for Jews, because, by OSI standards, all Israeli Jews have, quote, assisted, unquote, in persecuting people on the basis of race, religion, national origin, or political opinion, notably in oppressing the non-Jewish population of the occupied West Bank territory. Justice applied selectively is not justice. It's a form of injustice. The only elderly U.S. citizens targeted by the OSI are individuals associated with World War II Germany and its allies. What this means in practice is that the U.S. government is interested in prosecuting only individuals who have victimized Jews. The U.S. government is simply not interested in going after people who have persecuted non-Jews. The same U.S. government that banned Kurt Waldheim from this country and which has stripped worthy individuals of their citizenship and forced them into exile as refugees has welcomed Zionist leaders with well-documented records as criminals and terrorists, including two Israeli prime ministers, Yitzhak Shamir and Menachem Begin. Shamir, as head of the Jewish terrorist group known as the Lehi or Stern Gang, was personally involved in organizing the assassination of British Middle East envoy Lord Moyne in November 1944 and the murder of Swedish UN mediator Count Folke Bernadotte in September 1948. Begin and his Irgun organization carried out the terrorist bombing of the British administrative headquarters at the King David Hotel in Jerusalem in July 1946, as well as the notorious massacre of Palestinians in the village of Deir Yassin in April 1948. Both Shamir and Begin were officially regarded as criminals by the British government, which administered Palestine in the years before the establishment of the Zionist state. But none of this kept American presidents from rolling out the red carpet for these Israeli leaders in formal state visits to the United States. In 1995, it was revealed that Israeli soldiers had murdered hundreds of unarmed Egyptian prisoners of war and civilians by shooting them during the June 1967 war. Evidence and testimony of these crimes was widely reported in 1995, including in the Israeli press. An Israeli official who was asked about possible prosecution of Israeli soldiers for these murders responded by dismissively remarking that the events had occurred too long ago to merit consideration. That's pretty rich coming from a government that recognizes no time limit on its own insistent right to prosecute anyone, anywhere, for crimes committed against Jews. Something of the selective and one-sided notion of justice that's behind the Holtzman Amendment and the OSI's work was bluntly acknowledged in March 2001 by Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. Responding to a question about investigations of Israeli mistreatment of non-Jews in occupied Palestine, Sharon told Israel Radio, quote, "No one in this world has the right to put Israel on trial. No one. On the contrary, Israel may have the right to put others on trial, but certainly no one has the right to put the Jewish people and the state of Israel on trial." The U.S. deportation of Demjanjuk to Israel in 1986 was yet another expression of the privileged status that the U.S. government gives to Jewish concerns and interests. Israel put Demjanjuk on trial on the basis of its claimed right to punish anyone anywhere who commits what Israeli law calls crimes against the Jewish people. Israel's purported right is based on the premise that the Jews of the world, regardless of their citizenship or country of residence, constitute a uniquely privileged nationality. Demjanjuk was born in the Soviet Ukraine, and his alleged victims were Jews from Poland and various other European countries. Even if Demjanjuk were as guilty as his accusers claim, there is no legally valid reason under international law by which he should have been extradited to the State of Israel, a country which did not even exist at the time of the alleged crimes. By deporting Demjanjuk to Israel in 1986 to stand trial for crimes allegedly committed against citizens of various European countries, the U.S. government implicitly accepted the Zionist claim that the Jews of the world are first and foremost to be regarded not as citizens of the countries in which they reside, but rather as members of a supranational Jewish people with special ties to a foreign state. It's as if Ireland, for example, were to insist on the right to try American citizens accused of crimes committed in the United States against U.S. citizens of Irish ancestry, or if the Vatican were to claim the right to try persons accused of crimes committed anywhere in the world against Roman Catholics. By turning Demjanjuk over to Israel, the U.S. government showed that it accepted the Zionist double standard of one legal norm for Jews and another for everyone else. Zionist Jews claim this special supranational status when it serves their interest, while simultaneously demanding all the rights and privileges of citizenship of the countries in which they reside. The American writer Sam Francis cited a long list of abuses by the OSI in a biting column published in 1992. He wrote, "It has never been entirely clear why a U.S. government agency should concern itself with hunting down criminals who were not Americans, whose crimes were not committed on American soil, and whose victims weren't Americans either. The OSI has no authority to pursue and no interest in pursuing Japanese war criminals who committed atrocities against American POWs in World War II or any other war criminals from any other conflicts. The OSI strips you of your citizenship, calls you a Nazi and a war criminal, and sends you abroad to stand trial for your life under a foreign justice system. It's time to close down the OSI for good." OSI officials and its supporters claim that the OSI's work is motivated by a humanitarian concern for justice. That's a lie. The real motive is hatred and revenge, rooted in a worldview that regards Jews as a special and uniquely victimized people. This malevolent spirit has been noted by author and historian Patrick J. Buchanan. In a recent column about the Demjanjuk case, he wrote, "The spirit behind this un-American persecution has never been that of justice tempered by mercy. It is the same satanic brew of hate and revenge that drove another innocent man up Calvary that first Good Friday 2,000 years ago." The U.S. government campaign against Demjanjuk and other alleged Nazi criminals has included many individual miscarriages of justice. But as outrageous as each has been, they are overshadowed by the vengeful spirit and systemic injustice of the entire OSI campaign, which is an expression of the privileged status in American law and policy for Jewish Zionist concerns and interests, and of the Jewish Zionist grip on America's cultural and social political life. This alien hold is manifest, of course, in many other U.S. programs and policies, perhaps most shamefully in this country's decades-long support for Israel's occupation of conquered territories and its institutionalized oppression of non-Jews. The hijacking of American law and policy to further un-American interests has been made possible not merely because the organized Jewish community is influential and powerful, but also because too many Americans simply don't care what happens to their country and their world as long as they and their family and friends are happy and doing well, and because too many non-Jewish political leaders put their careers and personal interests above principle and above the interests of our country and of humanity. Thanks for being with me today. I hope you'll join me for the next World Watch broadcast. To learn more about the Institute for Historical Review and our work, please check out our website, ihr.org.
Thanks for listening. Mark Weber's World Watch returns Tuesday evening, 9 to 9:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Thank you.